Welcome to the podcast Mind Rewilding, Creating Conversations for Change with Melissa Ruckmick.
Today, we're honored to speak with Dr. Jonathan Ellerbe, two-time best-selling author, accomplished leadership and integrative wellness consultant, seasoned spiritual guide, ceremonialist, and fellow seeker. He has written 5 books, including his latest, The 7 Gateways of Spiritual Experience, Awakening to a Deeper Knowledge of Love, Life, Balance, and God. Welcome, Jonathan. Thank you for coming on our podcast.
It's an honor. I feel very fortunate to be here with you.
Yeah, I think we're both sitting in beautiful places. I'm looking out at this beautiful scenery and really enjoying it. And we're really excited to have you here. And I sure enjoyed reading your book and took lots of notes and wanted to really jump in with you about kind of what's going on with how this particular book with spiritual experience, how you grapple with the wordage and when you were writing things out.
Oh my gosh. The question about wording and language it's ever present for me. And I will tell you 2 things. On one hand, it was not a struggle, and I'll explain why. And in another way, it continues to be a struggle. So first, when I wrote it, I had a clear kind of calling and vision about what needed to be shared and how. So I was fairly relaxed in the way I approached the wording. I mean, I was sensitive to wanting to make it inclusive, to wanting it to be accessible, but I was also not wanting to water it down, especially on a topic like spiritual experience, so that it genericized everything or made things sound so vague and general that people would lose the distinction of what the heck we were actually talking about. So because of the topic itself, I would say the easy part was I felt I just needed to stay in that lane of using spiritual language. Okay, that's answer one. However, as I hold the book and as I talk about the book and as I promote the book, I mean, I'll be honest, I'm perpetually filled with angst and uncertainty because I know that all of the content in my book is contentious. I mean, no one would look at it and say, oh, that's a contentious book, but it is. What is spirituality? What is God? Who decides what's a spiritual experience? I talk about the spirit world. I talk about energy, synchronicity, miracles, all these things. And yet I want, and I think this is true in your work, I want people to understand that this is not esoteric. This is not otherworldly metaphysical. This stuff ultimately is as practical as any other topic. It's as concrete as any other topic, and it is as essentially transformative for people, communities, and our planet as any other topic. And in that way, I constantly struggle with language and wonder if I should have called it, you know, I was originally going to call it the super states of consciousness or breakthrough moments or the aha experience. Like, I don't know. It's a big thing. So there you go.
Words are a big thing. And you obviously found that I do study words and language. And what's fascinating to me is that that through line that you're talking about came through very clearly for me. And I think that what people need to know, and I wanted to just bring it up right away, because what I found in my research and working with people is that we all have so many hangups around bias and judgment just because of what we've learned in our lives and how we've learned. And we glom on to those things that are glom on to these words. So when you use the word God, for instance, like, I'll tell you right away, I at first was like, okay, well, so for me, and I think because of my travels, like you, we have a lot in common. We've traveled around the world. We've done a lot of work with indigenous cultures. We have, I think, both very broad perspectives around what the word spiritual means. And then that comes to the word God. Like, I think, don't you think still people, it's very hard for a lot of people to not associate that word to their belief system. So tell me what your thoughts are around, being okay with using that terminology for people and kind of helping them open up to what that really means, that word.
Yeah, I think it's an incredibly complicated word, and that was a very difficult decision. And I must say, it was my decision in the end to put the word God on the cover. And I had friends and family who even said, "Are you sure you want to use that word?" Because the assumption, and it's not incorrect, is that a huge group of people will think, "Well, he better be talking about my idea of God." Right. So there's this assumption that it's, well, typically it's a Christian God, or a Judeo-Christian God, or at least a Western concept of God, which that's not at all what I'm talking about. Or it's the other extreme reaction, which is if he's talking about God, I don't want to have anything to do with it. Because that word God has messed up so many things and caused so much disruption in culture and history and really has been at the root of so much violence. However, what we know through social science research is that there is an innate human longing to question and understand what God is. And in that sense, God is a placeholder word. It's a symbol for a mystery that we will never completely get our heads around, but other words like the universe or consciousness or the source energy, I mean, those words get at it. And yet, if it were just to be the universe in my title, I think there's a huge number of spiritual and religious people that would just not think I was talking about the ultimate nature of reality, which to me, God is the placeholder for. So I chose to put that word in as an intention to be a bit provocative. And also, because the title suggests that there is a new way to understand love and balance and God, hopefully a thoughtful reader would pick that up and say, "Well, what is a new understanding of God? Because I don't like the old one." Or, "What is the new understanding of God? Because I already have mine, but I'd like it to grow." Ultimately, if someone isn't incredibly prejudiced and unwilling to consider that God is something more than what they've known, probably that person's not going to be happy with my book anyway.
No, and probably they're not going to get to our podcast, Jonathan, because one of the things we're very clear about that it's just we really want to bring up questions and we want to do it bravely. And one of the things I got from your book right away, and I knew I needed to interview you, was that you very clearly made certain statements, but you also were very brave about saying, let's open this up for discussion. And that's what we're all about. Like, how can we shift our minds, the way we think about things, is that going to change the world? And that brings me into what do you think about mind rewilding to you? What does that mean? Because for us, it's changing all the time what that means.
Yeah, well, I love your work, and but it is also true I have my own filters in how I interpret it. But to me, it's so similar to what I feel I want to invite in the world, which is to remember that the mind is bigger than the intellect. That the mind is not the Western thought structure or the Western thought paradigm. The mind is much closer to the heart, the soul. It's much closer to conscious awareness. And what's happened in the modern West is that we've collapsed mind with thinking. And I don't even believe, and I think this is true for you also, that intellectual rational thinking even begins to cover the extent of what the mind is capable of. Just as a quick analogy, but then I want to go further. This morning, I noticed I was writing a note to someone, and I asked them if they would be willing to explain more about what they had previously written to me. And I stopped, and to me, this is rewilding. And I changed the word explain, and I replaced it with express. So for me, rewilding is about remembering that the mind, this is in the introduction to the book, Return to the Sacred, the mind is a small aperture through which we experience life, but we have our bodies, our senses, our hearts, our spiritual intelligence, and so many of these things used to be intact, used to be innate. So when we say rewilding, you know, for the listener, it's important to suggest a going back, even though ultimately it is forward moving, it is evolutionary, it is about our future. But it's a necessary phrasing because it reminds people that this is not something new. It's something ancient that's being remembered. It's something innate that's being remembered. And for me, the term wilding, as you probably would guess, is so essential and dear, because when we hear the word wild, you know, the two things that come to mind for so many people that I love about your choice of words is there is wild as in free and expansive, like without rigid constructs, but wild as in nature. And I think that the moment, and this to me is very important for, I think, for people to hear, the moment we started to turn nature into wild, as in savage, dangerous, other, was the moment we started to lose our souls, because our souls come alive in nature. And nature to date is the only text big enough to hold the spiritual journey. So rewilding for me, in your way, and also my own sort of rephrasing of things, I think it's the essence of what will lead us to a sustainable future and nothing less.
I'm really glad you said that. I really feel that too. And we'll come to that in towards the end. I have a question for you that is all about that. And I feel like also it's interesting because my early career, other than studying child psychology, was doing photography, which is what led me to expedition films. And so your reference to lenses, and really, you know, it does seem like going from that smaller aperture to this bigger aperture is really what we need. And I agree, we have to go back to sort of regain a wisdom and knowledge. And I think don't you think that's why a lot of us for many years, you know, during the 60s, especially, which we were children and were not even around yet, but people started to really question, what is this? Who are these, you know, amazing energies that we want to learn from? And they started really questioning that. So we started to open up our apertures, and then they seem to get closed down, you know, when things happen around the world. And I think one of the things, one of my theses is that I think that as human beings with these beautiful minds, we tend to get really caught. And of course, especially with social media and how technology is so wonderful and great to utilize, but it also carries us at a really fast pace right now. So I think it's really like our minds almost haven't quite caught up to being able to handle all of that and also be able to open up that aperture. Yeah. Because we're, you know, constantly being diverted because we can see all of the things that are going on in the world all the time. And I think partly that's why it's so important for us to have control over it, you know, and control over sort of what our mind brings in and what we see, and especially for children, but also for us as adults.
Yeah, it's interesting. I completely agree. And you said something that I think is so insightful. And I had this image, which I don't think, you know, a lot of people listening might think this is not a great image. But I almost imagine, you know, okay. Long time ago, once upon a time, I was in an outdoor survival program. It was a month-long program, and there were four different modules over the course of a month. And one of them, we were sort of in a tented base camp, and then we did activities out from there. And one of the fun activities was we made old traditional, quote, primitive hunting tools. And there's something called an atlatl. So an atlatl has like a little throwing arm for people who don't know what this is. Looks like almost like a ruler that has a little hook on the end. And then you have a long spear. And you hook the end of your spear, the butt end, not the head end, into the edge of the ruler, the arm, like kind of like at the dog park when you see people throw on the ball with a little orange grippy stick.
Right, that thing was made by from that design. That's
That's
really
exactly
funny.
what it is. So you're adding a fulcrum, and you know, there's some physics there. Anyway, here's the point. We would play this interesting game where it was atlatl golf. And they used it to teach us a variety of skills. And one of the things that was so fascinating as we explored new territory through this game was that you would throw this spear as far as you, I mean, really far as you could imagine. And it would be just at kind of the edge of your sight. And then you would walk towards it. And then you would discover your next goal. And then you would throw it to your next goal. And then you would walk towards it. And then you would discover your next goal. And the point here for people listening, if they're wondering, what's he talking about, is that life is very much like that. And in the 60s, I think what happened was there was this eruption of vision, and we threw our consciousness ahead like the atlatl, like the spear. It went into expansive places it hadn't gone before. It saw society in a way it hadn't before, sexuality in a way it hadn't before, but it was just the vision. And then we, as a culture, had to walk towards it, like the person who throws the spear, and be transformed by the journey. And then upon arriving to the spear, discover that there's a whole new landscape ahead. And I think that we have really just arrived at the technology, socially, technologically, scientifically, to begin to let us inhabit the visions of possibilities that were thought of in the 60s. At the same time, now that we are here, and things like social media is normal, and infinite knowledge in your pocket is normal, and all these other things, video calls are normal, global consciousness is normalized, we are again in this place of recreation. And what is that next vision? And then we will have to live and walk towards it. So there's this funny dynamic in human culture. And I'm sorry because it's a long answer, but just to emphasize
Okay.
for people, this is historically what has always been the case. And even if we go back and we look at the Galileos or the Buddhas or, you know, whatever monumental characters in time, they were always people who were ostracized and misunderstood in the moment because they saw a future that we still had to walk towards. And so when we struggle with what's going on in the world and ourselves, I think this image of living into our visions, living into our potential is really helpful. And I feel like you kind of raised this idea like this has been a journey. And something that was awakened then is only being realized now. And the things that are being awakened now will be realized by our children and grandchildren.
Yeah, I love that. And I really like the metaphor. Thank you for that. I mean, having been raised partly in Australia around Indigenous Australian people, I have those spears and I was gifted those things. And I'm very aware they're actually very, very proficient hunting
Crazy,
tools.
yeah, it's crazy.
But I'm so excited about the idea that you're bringing up because the whole idea that we're sort of evolving into this consciousness for me, I think that, don't you think that it will bring a lot of ease to people, understanding that, yes, we have a lot of work to do. Yes, we need to be more clear and careful about how we work with the planet and nature. And we want to make sure that we don't have species, you know, leaving our planet anymore. And we have a lot of work to do to clean it up. But on the other hand, we're also evolving. So I think there's sort of this grace and understanding that we're in this process. So I think a message, at least from me, that I think is very important for people to understand is that I think when a lot of people do, or people do choose, and we're going to go into this to dive deep into what we're going to utilize on this podcast is spiritual experience. And you've used that terminology too, for a lack of a better understanding, and really learned around, gotten really deep, whether it's in meditation, whatever work we've done, is that there is this humming. I like to call it a humming. There's this humming and beauty that is saying, you know, just keep moving, and you know, work it out and get better with the issues on the planet. But don't give up, you know, don't think that this is the end just because you're having trouble. You know, this is part of the process, and there's a lot to look forward to. And people like you and I feel like are bringing people along. You know, we're saying, come join us. Like, it's okay. We're going to be okay, but we do have to get real about what we need to do and the work we need to do.
Yes. So I wanted to jump in. Okay. I think that's absolutely essential what you're saying. And the way I would phrase it is that we need to normalize the journey itself, normalize the struggle. And this isn't to say, see, here's what I think we've been caught in, which is a kind of pendulum swing, where a generation or two ago had a kind of austere mentality, pre-technological exploration or explosion, I should say, in which the idea is that life's just hard and you got to suffer to get there. And there was a certain realism to that remains true, but there was also a kind of bitter resignation that we had to grow out of. And then what happened was we came through the 50s and 60s and really through the American engine, I would say, of commercialism and marketing and the dream of a better life, we swung to the other extreme, which is do what feels right and follow your bliss and do what feels good. And if it's right, you'll know. And the problem with that is that we've been promised such a life of comfort and ease and instant gratification that we've lost the fact that the truth is in the middle. The truth is neither the extremes right. of pain and self-deprivation. I don't think sacrifice and self-deprivation are the same. And but on the other hand, just because you have alignment or authenticity or a calling doesn't mean it's going to be free of work or struggle. You know, there's an article I wrote like 100 years ago, and it was called "A Red Flag Means Go." And the point is, as you were saying, for listeners that are on the journey, spiritual journey, personal growth, evolving change, change makers, we have to be careful that when things get hard, we don't immediately assume that that is, quote, the universe's message that this isn't going well. That actually might be exactly what it's telling you. This is right. going well.
Right.
And so we need to think of evolution as kind of moving in waves. There's going to be peaks and epiphanies, and then there's going to be the hard work, and then there's going to be the satisfaction of getting there, and then there's going to be maintenance. And, you know, it comes and goes, and that is normal. And I feel like for so many healing experiences in life, honest to goodness, I mean, I've been around hospitals and clinics and health resorts. 50% of the time, the best advice you get from any healer is, oh, that's normal. Just wait.
Right. That's absolutely. I mean, I think that the shamans and the medicine people and the healers I've been around all over the world, you know, there's a sort of this feeling of immediate, not trauma, but immediate sort of angst around the concept that there is a problem. or there's struggle. And for right. some reason, Indigenous people, because I don't know if it's the consumer society that we've built, I'm not sure, but it's triggered that sort of that fight or flight, right? And so that's why we're constantly almost, people mostly are in that, and we're trying to get ourselves off of that train so that we can actually say, hey, this is okay. It's okay. Today I had a hard day, or this happened. But, and don't you think that culture has a huge part of that, because we're so disassociated, at least in the Westernized cultures, to each other from our sort of our past, our community. Most of us are struggling with that still. We're trying to get community back. And I think when you have community, maybe that's why with more Indigenous cultures, you know, we can kind of more easily remind each other that it's okay, you know?
I totally agree. In fact, my concept of rewilding is about reintegrating both community and nature. Because when we're in community, we learn from adversity. We are lifted up because of adversity. We connect because of adversity. When we're isolated, adversity leads to depression and extreme coping behaviors. And similarly, when we are really immersed in nature, which is some of my most favorite retreat work to do with people, we discover that it's not just okay, but it's beautiful that nature sometimes tests our limits or challenges us with its cold or its hot or its dry or its prickly. But just to squeeze one last thing in before we go to the sort of the next step, I think mixed in with this, and getting back to the book, Spiritual Experience, is that we need spiritual visions and experiences in order to elevate us out of the struggle from time to time, so we can have that more expansive picture, so we can remember we aren't just what we do. In other words, there's this balance that occurs between doing the hard work, but staying connected to the transcendent, the capacity to experience a perspective that reminds us, oh, this is just a stage, or oh, this is part of the human condition, and more so, to have moments that elevate us so we can glimpse the future, that we can innovate, not based on the past, but based on spirit, based on consciousness.
Yeah. And in your book, you and everybody, please do read Jonathan's book, because one of the things that's really important I've found in the world is that it's important to get a hold of, and obviously everybody will migrate towards what is intuitively what they want to be learning at that time. But in your book, you do take people through that process of understanding that a spiritual experience, if we're going to call it that in words, is many, many things. And I think that the idea of what that can be, you and I both have had extremely unusual what we would call spiritual experiences, I think, because we kind of, I don't know about you, but I know that for my life and what I call my soul journey here, I've had to be brave. There are times when I'm like, no, I don't really want to do that. That's okay. I don't want to do that survival course, or I don't want to go become a medic and traipse around in the mountains and do all of that. But I've had to walk a path because I was listening. And I think that's where the intuitive part of helping people to understand, to really listen to their own intuition at any time of our moment in a day about who they listen to, what they do, you know, instead of sort of going on this scatter situation where I'm going to do all of these workshops, I'm going to read all of these books and panicking ourselves. It's like, it's okay, you know, just kind of go at what feels right for now, you know. What do you feel like your soul journey, what is it that your spirit wants right now? What will be best for it? And for me, like the extreme stuff that I think we have in common that we've both done, me for different reasons, because I was on really remote expeditions filming and had to become a medic and had to be able to, you know, suture people up and all those things. But it taught me so many things. And I guess I think what I hear you saying, and I totally agree, is like wherever your edge is, everyone out there, wherever your edge is, just keep moving towards it. You don't have to jump off. Just keep getting curious about what that edge is and who might be able to, you know, sort of help guide you there. If you need other than, you know, sort of this, what we're talking about, otherworldly guidance, which could take a whole podcast, right? Talking about how we find and each one of us captures sort of otherworldly energy and what we mean about that. So maybe we will get at that another time.
Yeah, although I could, if I could just add a little comment, I think you've brought up a really important topic in the world of spiritual growth, because I think there's often confusion about what it is. And to me, that can be understood in a variety of ways, but I like to think of it in terms of stages. And maybe you can think of them as concurrent paths, but there's definitely a time where we need to find out what feels right, what feels comfortable, what feels natural and aligned and authentic, and all that stuff. And we hear a lot of that in the self-help and personal growth world. It's a very comforting, very nurturing stage of the journey.
Right, catchphrases, yeah.
You know, and so, yeah, so it's all about comfort and being okay with ourselves as we are. That is absolutely essential, but that is not an end point. Because from there, we gather that confidence and strength and self-love, and we continue towards what you and I might call awakening or wholeness or integration. And that's when we use all the strength and confidence and love and clarity that came from being comfortable. And now we seek the edge. Because wherever we feel resistance, wherever we feel fear, wherever we feel judgment, wherever we long for control, you know that you are not free, because those are your impulses to protect yourself. And you only protect yourself when you don't feel safe, and you only do not feel safe if when you do not feel safe, you are not free.
Right.
And when I say free, for people who are listening, I mean free in your consciousness, free in your heart, free in your mind. I'm looking out my window. Two giant bald eagles just flew like right by my window.
That's absolutely not. I'm not by chance. I think that's so great. We're going to chat about that. I think also, well, so when is it that you felt totally safe in a really deep spiritual experience at first? You know, I think that that's what you're trying to say is that, and I think it's complicated, right, with people, because when I'm working with people one-on-one or I'm giving talks, people almost always ask me how will I know who to listen to, and B, how far should I go with an experience? And again, I think that's where the intuition comes in, because that's the razor's edge, right? Because nobody, it's like when you bring in plant medicine's a really good example here.
Yeah.
And I like using the word plant medicine, because the whole idea around hallucinogens is sort of a Western concept. So it doesn't mean they're psychoactive, but people have been very much curious about that, because I think they're trying to get to the edge. They're trying to find some answers and really learn. But the situation is that there's a razor's edge there with, it's okay, great, go towards it. But if you start feeling a vibration that is not something for you, then just, you know, divert to something else. And I think that, I mean, this is where, you know, things, when they become fads for people like us, we're like, oh, okay. Like, wait just a minute, you know, because you want to make sure it is the path for you and not push yourself down that path. That's why some people have had pretty serious reactions, right, to spiritual experience, whether it's plant medicine or something else.
So I would expand on what you're saying by saying, I'm going to be provocative and say yes and no, and I want to qualify the no, because I think you and I completely agree. So I'm going to give two analogies. And the first is the foundation of a lot of what I teach, even though it sounds a little cliche, which is the yin-yang concept, right? Which is 3,000 years old from China. And most of us know what that means. They see the picture of the swirling black kind of teardrop with the swirling white teardrop. There's a bit of white in the black, black in the white. But just quickly, as a framing, yin yang was never understood as two things in balance. In the origin, it's one thing. It's one thing with two principles that are organically and dynamically constantly interplaying. And in that sense, I believe anything we do, because this to me is the nature of the universe, anything we should do should reflect that same dynamic balance. So to your point, if you want to go somewhere wild with a psychoactive plant, well, set a safe setting, right? Don't combine wildness with wildness. Do your research, have good intention. So the no part for me is, well, I do believe in pushing the edge and going beyond your comfort zone, but only if that other piece has been put in place. Right. And so if it hasn't, then you're very right. Don't mess with something more powerful than what you understand. But the other analogy I wanted to set up is actually something you know so much more about than me, which is that when we think about extreme expedition travel or extreme nature sports, whether it's, you know, free diving or cliff jumping or bouldering or, you know, all these things, you know, unassisted ascents and all these sorts of wild things. And oftentimes we hear the stories and we only get the wildness of it. So-and-so went this far, that long, this high. We hear the extreme element. And very often the actual experience might be a few hours long, or the peak, right? So you summit Everest and, you know, the actual final ascent is like happens in a day. But what people don't often understand is the weeks, months, and sometimes years spent preparing to do something that looks so wild and dangerous.
Yeah. And, right? And sometimes easy. I mean, I think that's, it's so funny you say that, because people always say to me, well, you know, how long did it take you to do that documentary? I'm like, well, you know, probably 5 years. And there's so much preparation. And that's why I think people like seeing the making of things, because it sort of shows them exactly what goes on. And it's a great metaphor for people's lives, because it's like, okay, hey, like we're a work in progress. So just try to be easy on yourself. And if you feel like you're moving towards the edge, then just go to that intuitive place and ask yourself, is it time for me to try to move myself into a little bit of discomfort in order to grow? And for me, that's very important, so that people, and that's where the mind, the human mind does come into it, because can we mess it up? Absolutely we can. And we need to be prepared for what we're doing so that our mind and our whole being is really ready for an experience. And I think that that's really important. And it kind of brings me to, you brought in the word physics, and you did in your book, you talked about this a bit. And I just want to ask you, how much did your background and understanding physics really bring you into the concept around divine energy? Did that help you kind of wrap your head around it, or was it more playful because you understood physics? My family knew Dr. Feynman, Dr. Richard Feynman, Carl Sagan, and so we had very crazy dinner conversations around all of this, but I love the idea that you understand that. And I've often said to people, it really helps to have some knowledge of science, you know, when you're going into the sort of more spiritual or metaphysical or mystical world, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess for me, and just my experience, I would say it was sort of a curious weaving of those worlds. I've never been against science. I've always been interested in science. So there was nothing resistant around the scientific world or model or language before I entered any of my spiritual experiences. However, I will say, particularly in the experiences of divine energy, which for people listening is a chapter of the book, I will say that those experiences were so spontaneous and so radical and so unexpected that I would say there was nothing really that prepared me for them, or or set them up. There was it wasn't like a gradual immersion into a concept that then came to life. It was more the other way around, which was that I had these experiences, excuse me, and then there was kind of a aha, almost in retrospect, like, oh, what I saw was what's going on at the quantum level.
So did
What
it
I
help you
saw.
more, Jonathan, with the integration? Is that what you're saying?
Yes,
Like sort of the
yes.
other side? So maybe you can speak a little bit about that, because I know in ceremony there's a lot of discussion. Like I'm involved with the MAPS discussions in Canada about integration and the importance, no matter what we're doing, of integrating and having people to back us up when we have an experience, whatever it is.
Yeah,
Yeah.
well, so there's no question that it helped with the integrating. And what I mean by that, if this is a little vague for someone else, imagine that you have this experience in which, you kind of temporarily dissolve as if in a virtual reality experience into a world that is only color and energy and vibration. And you see patterns and you feel movement, and in it, in the moment, you're so consumed with it, you can't even think about it. It's just like a big wow. But then you come out of it, and I think this happens too often. If you don't contemplate and reflect and cherish that this was a window into reality and not a s escape from reality, you can kind of shake it off as almost like, whoa, I tripped out. I'm not going to talk about that again.
Right. It
But
won't
what
go to the
we're,
fear place. Yeah.
right. But when we have an open heart for the sacred and an open mind to a deeper understanding of reality, we ask a different question, which is, what did I see? And does this reveal something that actually matches the physical world? And as we look into the world of physics, and really now we have deeper levels of physics than even 20 years ago. I remember when the film What the Bleep came out, that was a very
Right.
famous, documentary, and a lot of the science was, a bit colorful and padded, and then some of it was very rigorous and detailed. And it was pointing to this idea of the quantum realm, right? There's this sub-manifest realm that isn't available to the eye, but it explains what we're seeing at the atomic level. There's something even deeper. Well, where I wanted to go with it today is to say, yes, that helped me for sure to know that it wasn't just fantasy and imagination that I was experiencing, that something in the spiritual realm absolutely mirrors or even is a window to the physical realm. But today, in what we call high energy physics, which is a newly developed physics, it's at the heart of new astrophysics, it's the heart of mathematics now. I mean, it's a very profound field. What they are showing is taking us even deeper into the spiritual realm, and it shows that all reality that we've studied to date, down to what they call the Planck scale, which is this, let's just say really teeny, teeny, tiny level of reality, that it's just the tip of the iceberg. And
Right.
not only is it just the tip of the iceberg, but the thing that's profound below it is that it is kind of analogous to dark matter in space. It is not only appearing to be in the most rigorous math and physics today the vast majority of what is real, but it exists beyond time and space.
Yeah, I think
And
that's so exciting.
isn't that phenomenal? So that tells me
Yeah.
not only can we use theoretical physics and particle physics and quantum physics to kind of verify what we experience in the energy realm, we can continue with science, move into this dimension beyond, quite literally, beyond time and space. And we find that the mystical realms, the formless divine, the pure consciousness are even further affirmed. And those are actually also chapters in the book.
Right. No, absolutely. And I think that that's what's so great. So any of the negativity that any of us have learned around, sort of calming curiosity around all that, people just let it go, because I think it's really exciting to be able to free our minds enough to start to really grasp some of these concepts that are going to be coming along. And the bottom line is, we'll probably never know everything ever, but maybe we're not supposed to know, just like sometimes we're not supposed to dive over that edge, and we need to know that. And one of the things, though, I want to bring it around full circle. So everything in your book, so when you look at your background and you're kind of looking at your experiences and you're integrating them, and obviously hopeful of shifting people a bit so that they can start to reimagine themselves maybe in a different way in the world, how do you feel like this sort of movement towards opening ourselves up and recultivating things and learning more about ourselves will actually eventually help our situation with peace in the world? Because I feel like that's a through line for everybody right now. There's this undercurrent of, we've got a lot going on we're not okay with.
Yeah. And it's interesting. I appreciate that you caught that because it's a through line for me. And it does frame the beginning and the ending of the book, which is to say, if nothing else, the seeking of spiritual experience will foster a better world. And so the way I see it connected, I guess it's a few ways. So the first thing is, I would say that all system collapse, whether it's personally, in a relationship, in a community, or on a broader ecological scale, results from narrowing. So when you reduce diversity, when you become rigid in worldview, all these sorts of things lead to a kind of fragility that is quite literally vulnerable in the sense of extinction. However, when we look at resilient systems, resilient relationships, resilient communities, what we see is expansion. We see the capacity to expand and include, adapt and consider. And spiritual experiences innately lift us from the narrowness of our lives and allow us to glimpse a more expansive, interconnected view of life. So this is a huge gift for anyone in any profession, certainly for thought leaders, but for parents and whatever, people working in a grocery store or people running a company. To immerse yourself in spiritual experience is to begin to open your mind to possibility, to interconnection, and to the realization that perception is profoundly relative and always changing. That's huge for a sustainable future. But there's another thing that emerges consistently throughout spiritual experience, which is that the feeling of interconnection turns into compassion. It turns into stewardship. It turns into an expanded identity. And I actually want to share a little concept to close this that I think is really profound. When we look at the neurology and the science of mind and human development, we see this curious thing that raises some fear for people, some doubt and suspicion, which is that the oldest parts of the human brain, the brainstem, evolutionarily speaking, are all oriented around survival and fear. That's just a fact. We are fearful creatures. And so we are built to protect the self. Now,
To survive. Yeah, we're built to survive.
right. Now, some would say this is the justification for why the world will always fall to greed and violence. But no, because another thing that has prevailed throughout human history, from the earliest expressions of human culture, is spiritual experience. Now, when you combine spiritual experience, which is about the expansion of the self, with the physiological impulse to protect the self, what happens when my idea of self starts to include you? and starts to include my neighbors and starts to include my enemies and starts to include the oceans and the forests and the air. Well, all of a sudden that primal drive to preserve self becomes the primal drive to champion life, to be a steward of vitality and diversity, and to truly see the well-being of all as my own, and the well-being of myself as inextricably related to all other beings. It's a necessary part of our future transformation. We can't get there without at least what I call spiritual experience.
Yes, I completely agree. I mean, I think there's other words for it, but I feel very strongly. Thank you for that. And I feel like also let's tenderly in children here. I know there's a lot of families with young children that are really struggling right now just to try to keep all the pieces together. And also, you know, to be learning what you're talking about, how can we help our children to think outside the box, no matter what our family's belief systems are, and be able to stay really open to that? What are your thoughts around that right now? It's just so, they're so great, these little children that are coming in.
Yeah, I love that question. And actually, your work is a big part of my answer. I think that rewilding for children is critical. Keep them connected to nature. Keep them connected to creativity. Help them to feel connection more than division. And for parents listening, like, pay attention. None of these are religious, but they can operate in your religious tradition. None of these are so prescriptive that you can't do it your own way. But time in nature, time off of technology, time connecting with others and in community, not feeding fearfulness of other or difference. The creative arts, I think, are definitely a part of it. And being curious with the, I don't want to use the word creativity again, with the expansiveness of your child's mind.
Right, their questions. Don't be afraid of their questions.
Don't be afraid of their questions. And don't be afraid of what they see.
Right.
Because, you know, if your child says they saw a fairy, or they believe Santa Claus, you know, being past their window or whatever, how does it serve you to crush that?
Right.
What are you preparing them for? A narrow world of cynicism? Yeah. Like, if these things aren't real, their experience will bear it out. But I would challenge most parents and say that too many parents are telling their children too young that things are not real.
Right.
That I actually, as an adult, still believe are real.
Right. We don't know what's real, right? There's a lot we don't know, just like you said. So we're bringing it back to that, everyone. So we don't really know. Get curious with your kids, and it might even open up portals of learning for ourselves. And on that note, I asked Jonathan to end with a poem that he had in the book that really, I think, speaks to part of what we're doing in this podcast. And so I'll say right now, thank you so much for being here and supporting us for this podcast, Mind Rewilding, Creating Conversations for Change. And with our amazing guest today, Dr. Jonathan Ellerbe, and his new book, The Seven Gateways of Spiritual Experience, Awakening to a Deeper Knowledge of Love, Life, Balance, and God. And here we go to Jonathan for his poem, and we will see you next time.
Well, thank you, Melissa, for having me. This has been really wonderful. And you've picked something pretty deep and profound. So I'm going to ask people to take a little breath. This is like an excerpt of high mysticism. But it's also the essence of our salvation as a species. When no discriminating thoughts arise, the old mind ceases to exist. When thought objects vanish, the thinking subject vanishes. And when the mind vanishes, objects vanish. Things are objects because of the mind. The mind is such because of things, objects. Understand the relativity of these two and the basic reality the unity of emptiness. In this emptiness, the two are indistinguishable, and each contains in itself the whole world.
Thank you, Jonathan.
There's something to think about. All right, thank you so much, and thank you for your work and for having me.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Mind Rewilding, Creating Conversations for Change with Melissa Ruckmick. Soundtrack by Aaron Gallagher and Luke Mathers. Mesa Sound.